Les colloques du Collège de France.
So do you feel how your flow network is adapting to the flow? Sadly, you don't. But it's actually happening right now in your brain while you're shifting from, you know, chatting to your neighbors or looking at like your last emails to now focusing on this person on the street, on the stage here. What is happening is that different regions of your brain now need glucose than with the other task. And so how your brain is accommodating for that is that vessels in your brain dilate and others shrink, and thereby they're rerouting the glucose flow. And this is in fact like an adaptation due to the flow itself. And that's the topic of my talk today. Flow networks are abundant throughout life as the vessels pervading us, the beautiful venation patterns we observe in leaves, but also in a very pure form as the entire body of fungi and slime molds. These are really important entities for the functioning of organisms because they are the mean to transport resources and signals across the vast body they're serving. And for this to happen efficiently, it all relies on this morphology of these networks to be the right one. And in life, to ensure that this morphology here is the right one, what is going on is that these networks are dynamic and they're continuously adapting, shrinking, or dilating to make sure that we have this correct morphology. And so what does it mean to have a correct morphology? Well, if we zoom into a vasculature and at a junction we measure the diameters of these vessels, then it turns out that they are optimized for efficient transport obeying so-called Murray's law, this geometric relation. Now, the striking observation is that this law is not only true for our vessels, but also actually in slime molds and fungi. And that's really surprising, right? Because, I mean, from the biological makeup, animals and fungi can't be like further away. Like the biological makeup is really, really starkly different. And yet they do obey the same physical law. So this tells us what is driving the morphology of the network can't be down to the biology, but it has to be due to the physics, and that's what's actually shared across these organisms, that what's governing the physics here is the laminar flow in long, slender tubes. And so Ori Murray coined the idea that fluid flows drive these tube diameter dynamics. Yet, how flows drive these tube diameter dynamics, that could be in a variety of ways. Because just by having flow through a tube, the flow in a tube is exerting a hydrostatic pressure, the flow is shearing, the walls of the tube is exerting a shear force, and the flow is transporting your glucose in the brain and is thereby governing resource availability. So which of those is actually governing the dynamics of tubes if they're growing or shrinking? Well, it's very hard to tell. I mean, how should I, in an experimental data set, how should I measure the pressure? The pressure is very hard to measure. And it actually points to why the physics underlying flow networks is really challenging. Because if we zoom out and look at an entire network of tubes, the pressure in one tube is actually a function of the flows throughout the entire network. What it means is, say, now this one tube responds to, say, an increase in shear force by dilating. What it means is now that this now bigger tube is sucking in more fluid. And because this one is sucking in more fluid, neighboring tubes get less. So they get less fluid, and they might go and respond to this decrease in the shear force. And you can see how, by this global coupling of flows, that's making it challenging from the physics side, we find a feedback between flow and morphology. And it's my goal to understand this working of the feedback between flow and morphology. And I do so by combining experimental observations with quantifications and theoretical models and trying to create a big picture of that. My roadmap to untangle this feedback between flow and morphology is the following. I'm interested in what is the local flow feedback? What is the quantity that's driving tubes to grow or to shrink? I'm interested in the role of network hierarchy, with which I refer to some tubes being bigger and some being smaller, so a difference in the tube radii, in a sense. I'm interested in the network topology, so what's the role of having loopy versus tree-like networks, and how are these quantities actually taking control of network function? Today, I worked on all of these topics, and today I will just give you two spotlights looking into these concepts. And I will start so by looking at the role of local flow feedback. Now, this is the time latest where you should have have a question mark in your brain because, hey, if you talk about these networks on the slide, they don't look at all like all my brain vessels, right? And they are not, right? These microscope images are images of the model organism that we use in the lab, Physarum polycephalum, and let me just quickly introduce you to the system. So Physarum that you see here on the left in an arena of food sources, these are food sources, is a single-celled organism, although here sort of having 5 millimeters up to 1 centimeter in size, can be much bigger even. What's going on is here is that we have thousands of nuclei that are engulfed in a single cell envelope. And now this single cell envelope is actually organized as a network. And this network is very dynamic and reorganizing over time. That said, the reorganization isn't as dramatic as you see it here. This is actually a data set that was taken over the course of 3 days. So this is the amount of reorganization of the network morphology that you see over the course of 3 days. Now, what I find striking is that if you look at the migration of Physarum, it does still remind you of a single cell, right? It looks a little bit like a keratocyte, or who's foraging around. Yet here, it's much, much bigger in size and has this peculiar network structure. And if we zoom into this network, we see that within the network, we have strong fluid flows shuttling in one direction and then changing directions and shuttling in the other direction. If you were to focus on this part up here, you see what's going on. You see that these tubes are rhythmically contracting. So what is going on is that these tubes, they're lined with an actomyosin network, and actomyosin, that's the same building block as our muscles. So basically, you have a muscle-like structure around these tube walls, embedded in the tube walls, and now these muscles are undergoing rhythmic contractions. And as a tube is contracting, the fluid flow that's inside and this tubular structure is being displaced and then it flows through the network. And now it turns out that these contractions are actually organized across the entire network such that you have a fluid flow, you have a contraction that's pumping the fluid flow in one direction and then it's flowing back. So you really have large scale flows that are extending across the entire organism. Now, why is this a good system to study adaptation to fluid flows? Well, first of all, this organism has been shown in instances to obey the Murray's law. So it obeys the same geometrical laws that we observe in our vasculature. And it's just an amazing system to quantify. So the one and only thing that we can do in Physarum, which is tremendously hard in all the other model systems that I would be excited to study, is that here we can image the entire network. And we cannot only image the entire network, we can even quantify the fluid flows in parallel at the same time. So we have direct access to all quantities. We have the flows, we have the contractions that are driving flows, we have the tube diameters as they are adapting over time, and we actually know the physics. So we can actually take these contractions and derive the fluid flows, and we even get the pressures, because we can predict the pressures in the systems. So we really have access to all physical variables, and that's only possible because we can image the entire network. And that makes it an ideal system to study these concepts. And so the concept, as I said, that we're really interested in is to ask what property drives a tube to dilate or to shrink. And so this is actually a joint project with a student in my group, and Sophie Mabach, who now, lucky you, is just next to you at Sorbonne. And so they took data on like imaging the fluid flows in these networks and measuring the tube diameters over time. And so if we map them out, what we see is the following. So in these tubes, we verify that it really obeys what we expect from laminar flow in long, slender tubes. If we now, over time, map out the tube radius in blue, we see that, and here tube radius, I should stress, is are not the short time scale contractions. We're averaging over those, and we're just interested in the long time adaptation of these tube diameters, of the tubes shrinking or growing over timescales of 10 minutes to an hour. And so you here see that indeed the tube diameters are growing and shrinking on this timescales of a couple of minutes. Now, if we map out the shear rate from measuring the fluid flows, we see that there's a clear correlation. So the shear rate in red goes up, and a little later, the radius goes up. The shear rate goes down, a little later, the radius goes on, and so on. So what we learn here is that the shear rate is driving the tube diameter dynamics, although there's a little bit of a time delay in it. And it turns out that this time delay of 2 minutes is actually important. So we can cast these dynamics in equations to describe now the tube diameter A as a function of time to adapt to the shear stress that's sensed at the tube wall to a reference shear stress, and that this sensed shear stress is a function of the actual shear due to the fluid flow with a time delay. So it works. And we can actually go in and we can measure all kinds of tubes. And for all tubes, we can take these equations and we can fit them to our data. And we do predict that shear is perfectly driving the dynamics of the tubes. So I could be done with the story now. But then we looked in and we were puzzled, because when we looked in the dynamics of the tubes, we saw this. So what we see here is now the shear rate versus the tube radius. And I'm picking two tubes. And there's one tube here, which is staying around, and it's happily kind of circling. So the shear rate goes up, a little later the radius goes up, the shear rate goes down, the radius goes down, but it's stable. And then I have another tube where the shear rate goes down and the radius keeps going down and the entire tube is shrinking away. So they're both obeying exactly these dynamics, that the shear rate is governing the tube radius. But what was puzzling us is that we start out with basically two tubes that have a similar radius and a similar shear rate in the very beginning, and yet they end up doing entirely different things. So we can understand the dynamics in time, but we are somehow lacking a predictive power to say what will happen to a tube. Will it stay, or will it actually shrink away? So what is driving that? And looking at individual vessels, we couldn't solve the problem. So we had to look at entire networks. And just to emphasize that the shear rate has no predictive power, let's look at this entire network that's reorganizing over time. It's starving and a lot of veins are pruning away. And if we map out the shear rate at this initial time frame, which is this one, there's no predictive power in saying that those with high shear rate will vanish and those with low shear rate will stay. So what is missing is the following insight that we could only achieve by reminding us on high school physics knowledge. Because it turns out if you look at a flow network, you can exactly map it to an electric circuit, right? Where now every tube is a link in your electric circuit with a certain resistance. And what's different for Fusarium is that here we always have some inflow due to the pumping. But it's basically a resistance network. And if you remind yourself to your high school physics, right, your teachers ask you to do this calculations of like you have three resistors in parallel, like what's the equivalence resistor that you could replace it with, right? Or if you have them in series, you know, there was another law of how you could recalculate them. So if you have this in mind, then you will believe me that, you know, this is a way of how we could actually simplify this network as well. So if I'm interested in the dynamics in this green tube here, what I can do is I can look at this green tube here and I can subsum the entire topology of the remaining network into an equivalence resistance over here. And by doing that, I arrive at being able to predict the shear rate in this tube that I'm interested in as a function of the entire network morphology. So remember, this was our equation for the adaptation dynamics of the sense shear relative to the shear of the fluid flow. And now I tell you that the shear in the flow is actually given by this expression. And what is the important insight is there's this one variable down here, R net. So this is this equivalence resistance of the remaining network. And the core insight is that this equivalence resistance is a unique property of the vein I'm looking at. So the equivalence resistance of the remaining network is something that is different for every individual tube that I might be looking at in the network. And it's this one that's setting here the target shear rate that you want your tube will adapt to. And so if we remember we had two equations. Like this never happens, right? That you start with complex biological problems and then in the end you end up with just two numerical equations like textbooks, Strogatz, nonlinear dynamics. It never happens. It happened. And so we can just go to like map out the dynamics from our textbook, like looking at what is the dynamics that we'd expect from these equations, mapping out again the shear rate with this radius. And indeed, we do find like this circling motion that we observed in our data, or veins that are shrinking. Now, the insight is that what defines if a vein is hanging out or if it's shrinking is the position of these, what we call stable fixed point, these dots here. And now, the insight is that the position of these dots in this dynamics, they depend on this R net. So you can have the same tubes, but for one tube, its phase diagram looks like that at this radius and at this shear rate that's happily stable. But for another one, this whole diagram is actually shifted to the far left. And although it has the same radius and the same shear rate, it's actually in this regime because of the difference in R-net. So the simple way to understand this is that if you are a small vein and you're surrounded by big veins, then you will prune away. You will shrink away. You're irrelevant. But if you're the same small vein and you are next to similar small veins, you will stay around. That's essentially what the R-net does. And so now taking that, we can actually follow the dynamics in, this is a subset of the network, and what we're doing here is we're mapping out the resistance, the R-net, the resistance of a vein over R net, the R over net. And if it's red, it should prune away, and if it's blue, it will stay. And just mapping out which veins are red at every time instant, we actually correctly predict which veins are the red ones here have pruned in the next time step, and the red ones here have then pruned in the subsequent time step. So we do have predictive power of predicting which veins will add in the future prune away and which one will stay by having the insight that the entire network morphology is governing the fate of a single vein. And this can actually also result in the collapse of an entire region, as we see here, and it's very easy to understand how such a cascade of events can happen. So imagine that we have this subset of a circuit, and say all veins have the same resistance, small r, and I only have one vein that has a resistance that's twice as big. And so for this one, this will be the one that's like the thin tube surrounded by thicker tubes, right? So the purple one will prune away. But once the purple one is away, what happens is that the blue one, because this node point is gone, all of a sudden the blue vein is twice as long. And a vein that's twice as long actually has twice the resistance. Huh. And so now blue is, over time, sort of gaining in resistance just by taking away this blue, this node point, and then this one will prune away, and so on. So you can see this by this topological transitions, due to pruning, you get a cascadation of network reorganization. So in summary, we learned that this local control of tube diameters is due to shear force, although with a time delay, and that the tube dynamics really depend on the tube's dynamic in the network. And that's why having this in total view of the network is really important to be predictive over the dynamics for the future of a tube. So we learned how a network is reorganizing its morphology over time. So now I want to ask, how does this network morphology actually impact the functionality of this network? So let's go into the setting of Physarum and first of all now define what are the functional parts of this network. And this is now work by my PhD student Lisa Schick. So first of all, we have the fan fronts. This is where mass is moved to. And it's moved from the rear of the network. And so the motion of mass from the rear to the front, this is setting up the migration direction. Now, let's look at these dynamics on a plate. And so I want you to follow this one down here, which starts out as a like very interlaced network, but you see that over time, it's really dramatically changing its network architecture, becoming like lightning-like, which reminds us of the horrible weather we had yesterday, but then also going back to like this very like interlaced shape. So that was very busy, right? Let's try to do some housekeeping here. So if we look at these network morphologies, we can actually identify three different states or archetypes. So first of all, we have the stationary state, with this interlaced network, which is not moving, but hanging out on a spot. Then we have a crescent shape, where we have a migration front with these fans here, still thick and thin interlaced veins, and it's moving slowly. And we have a lightning state, which has only kind of thick veins, and it's moving very fast. Now, just giving names to different archetypes, I don't know, is there a way we can measure them? So let's go in and quantify these different states. And so to quantify now these different states, we look at the migration, which we quantify by the speed of these fans, versus a measure of how extended is this network. And for that, we use the scaled radius of duration, which is normalized by the area. So we don't count how big the network is, but we're interested in, is it like symmetric, like disk shape, or is it extended? And so if we now measure all these networks that we found on our plates, we see that the stationary state is rather slow and symmetric shape. Then the crescent is a little faster and a little more extended. And eventually the lightning state in blue is the fastest and has the most extended shape. And we can further quantify the shape of the network also, and they're nicely correlated, right? And we can further quantify the shape of the network by the solidity, which is a measure of compactness. So say I take a stationary state and I count the amount of pixels of this network in black, and then I divide that by the amount of pixels I would find if I encircle this entire network. So for disk, the solidity would be one, right? And so you see also for the stationary states overall, I have a very high compactness, whereas the lightning state has a low compactness. And again, these measures nicely correlate with the radius of gyration. So we found three parameters: migration speed, radius of gyration, and solidity, which now allow us to train a neural network to efficiently and robustly identify all these states in all our data sets. And we're really down to just three archetypes. But it's three archetypes, and that's entirely opposite to what we were expecting. Because literature tells us that we should expect one archetype. The whole idea of starting from Murray and how flow networks organize tells you that if we look at, say, a venation pattern we find in a specific plant, that this venation pattern has one archetype. It's either very dendritic or it's like tree-like. It's either interlaced or it's tree-like. And the result is due to the balance of cost during the evolutionary process. And the evolution should have pushed the network to obey one state, which is a function of the cost. And here we observe three. So let's stick to this idea that there are costs that are driving the evolutionary process and actually go in and quantify these costs. So the two main costs that are discussed in the literature is the transportation cost, which would be the dissipation you have just due to the friction of the fluid flows in the tubes, and the building cost, which is basically the volume of the entire network. So let's quantify those two by looking at this network where we observe the transition from a crescent state to a lightning state at very high time resolution. And what you can already see is that the overall volume of the network is going down. So the building cost is going down. At the same time here, we can measure the fluid flows in this network by calculating them from the contractions. And so we can also faithfully track out the transport cost. And so what we see over time going from black to bright colors is that the building cost goes down, but at the same time, the transport cost goes up when we go from crescent to lightning. So there seems to be a trade between these two cost categories, transport and building cost. And that's actually something that we also do find in our big data set.
How do you measure transport costs?
So in this case, we take the contractions, and from the contractions, we can calculate the fluid flows, and from the fluid flows, we can calculate the dissipation, because the dissipation is just the conductance of the tubes and the flow and the tubes. It's a little harder in these plates, because in the plates, we actually have to invoke a model of the flow will be that in such a network architecture. But we can also faithfully do this, and we can use this data set to verify that, so that we can now calculate the transport costs in these data relative to the building cost. And we find the same trend. So the crescent shapes are at moderate building costs and at moderate building transport costs on average, whereas the lightning on average is at higher transport cost but lower building costs, and then the stationary state is at the opposite end at high building cost and low transport cost. And again, we have this data set also pictured down here. So you see there's a bias due to the size of these networks, exemplified by the size of the bubbles, but there is this overall trend that you're trading transport with this building cost. So there seems to be a constraint due to these building costs that's setting up which morphologies I can have in the network. But the missing thing is, why do we have them, right? Why do we have these different archetypes? And so to this end, let me try to quantify the functionality of these networks. So to quantify functionality, we ask, what is the search strategy that is associated with these different archetypes? And to this end, the organism is finding new food in its fan regions, in its growth fronts. This is where it would detect new food sources. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to mark the direction of the organism with the radius of gyration, and then I'm going to ask, where is it actually probing for food, in which orientation? And so if I measure that for all these three archetypes, then we see that the lightning is basically only probing in the direction that it's oriented in, versus stationary incursion that are kind of looking everywhere around a little bit. So we have a multidirectional probing versus a unidirectional in the lightning state. But then another aspect would be, I'm not just like probing in one direction, but the question is also like, how much am I actually scanning this environment? And to quantify that, I want to measure the fan width. So what I do is I map out the fans in the network and I project them on a circle, and then I measure what is actually the width of the fan of this fan by quantifying the angle, which is the scanning angle of the system. And looking at the distribution of those, we see that the crescent one is actually scanning in really wide fans, which is what we see here in the inset already. But the lightning and stationary, they have very peak distributions where they're only just looking at a small angle. And so if we look at this whole slide together, we see that each individual archetype has a different function. So we observe there's three archetypes. They seem to be constrained by the balance of building and transport cost, but allow for the whole range of functionalities. And so taken together, we find that network topology is dynamic and it's mapping to function. And obviously it would be now lovely to ask, you know, is the network morphology that we observe, is it a function of the past? Is the organism learning? And just if you allow me 2 more minutes, I will quickly put what we learned in Fusarium in a broader context to show you that looking at flow networks is not something that's relevant for understanding slime molds, but it's actually overall a cool question, because we do have flow networks everywhere. So like also our batteries, our like trying to get oil or gas out of rocks, this is all a function of flows through porous systems that you can nicely study in microfluidic devices. And again, you can map out flows and transport dynamics, and you can really understand how the network architecture determines those. And what we see is that these man-made systems, they're not as efficient as the living systems. And it's very inspirational to think about, if we understand the physics of life, can we use them to make better batteries, because they're going to be better in transporting resources. And in this realm, I'm working with Joachim Redler and Gabriel Amsterdam at Ecole Polytechnique, and we're sort of probing, like making active devices by now printing structures in responsive hydrogels. And in these hydrogels, we can then flow enzymes through these hydrogels and change the morphology, sort of really putting the workings of nature into in silico systems with the aim to build complex behavior also in silico. And similarly, I'm not satisfied by just looking at flows and Fusarium. I actually do care about vasculature. And so we have this cool setup by a postdoc in my group where we actually look at these are human cells that are growing vessels on a microfluidic chip. So here we have inflow from the top, outflow from the bottom, and we again can quantify both the flow and the morphology and how it's reorganizing over time. And I hope we can use the system to actually learn how we can program function into human vasculature. And so with this in mind, I first of all want to convince you that there's a lot of physics on flow networks, and I wouldn't be here if there wouldn't be people who would fund my research. I'm very grateful to those. But honestly, I'm much more grateful to this long list of people, wonderful people that work with me and I enjoy chatting to. And you should care about flow networks because we have them everywhere in our body and they're around us in every case. Thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.